Okay, Boker Tov. Good morning, everybody. We're coming to the end of the Megillah. I just want to say a little bit over what I said on Sunday, because it's actually online if you want to listen to the whole thing, about the question of the future of the holiday of Purim. Is it going to be around forever? And I spoke about it because there is a very famous statement. It's brought here in the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, and it's also mentioned in the Midrash Mishle. Why is it Mishle and not Midrash Esther? I don't know. We read it last week that it says these days of Purim lo ya'avru will not pass by, will not go away. So the Midrash says melameh shafila kol ha'mo'adiv yubetelib. Even if all the holidays will go away, there won't be Pesach, there won't be Shavuos, there won't be Sukkos. Have you made Purim lo yibatlu? Purim will always be there. Very strange. Right, with all due respect, that we've got a statement here which seems to suggest Purim has got an eternal value. So the question is, of course, what are the rabbis trying to say? Are they saying that Purim will always be there and Pesach won't? Right, so some of the rabbis say, well, because Mashiach will be a time of great miracles. And those miracles will be so great that the miracles of Egypt will be forgotten. Because, you know, if you've got 10 and you've got 100, you go for the 100. The 100% is going to be so much more than what we've had till now. That's one explanation. But why Purim survives? Because Purim is about hidden miracles. And the answer is, that's the point. Now, Purim is about the hidden miracle, which is always going to be there. Right? We know that the open miracle concept went away a long time ago. We don't have it today. Right? We don't have a big hand coming down from heaven and thunder and lightning and all the rest of it. It just doesn't exist. But we do recognize what we call Yad Hashem, the hand of God. And we see it in so many ways, and we see it in so many situations. And, you know, I'm just looking now at the presidential situation coming up. And, you know, you can see a Yad Hashem going on there as well. Not quite sure how it's going to play out. But, you know, if we have a candidate at the moment who is saying that he wants to take money, and it's a Jewish candidate, supposedly, and he wants to give it to Hamas, then we've got someone that we have to pray doesn't become the leader of this country. Because if he's giving money to terrorists, I don't quite understand what the whole discussion about him is really about. If that is what he really said. Of course, you have to sort of verify what he actually said. Yes.
2016 election.
Yeah. Well, again, it depends who you talk to. In this country, you talk to most Jews in this country, they won't quite call it a miracle. They might have another word for it, right? In Israel, they will call it a miracle. Oh, yeah, they really do. They really see the presidential situation in this country as miraculous, in the sense that you've got a president who's never been as pro-Israel ever in the history of the state of Israel, right? And that includes people, you know, like Clinton and all the rest of them, who maybe, you know, made overtures to Israel, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was questionable. So you've got to say that there is this concept that the message of Purim, what Purim represents, that will always be something that never goes away. Right? And I quoted, and again, I'm not going to sort of say more of the shir, because as I said, it's online on YU Torah, and it's a nice shir, 45 minutes, and it really is worth, I hope, worth listening to, because it was a nice discussion. The concept, says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, the very famous rabbi of the 1700s, who had the whole problem with the Shabtai Tzvi situation. He was one of the rabbis that got caught up in the whole melee. Him and Jonathan Abershitz, and the very, very famous dispute between the two rabbis, whether they believed that Shabtai Tzvi was the Mashiach, wasn't the Mashiach. Just listening to a whole broadcast about that as well. And the bottom line, says Rabbi Emden, is that we've had miracles in Jewish history. We've had miracles that we know about in the Torah, miracles that have happened in Jewish communities up and down all over the world, essentially, things that have happened. And at the same time, says Rabbi Emden, he wrote this 300 years ago, there's one miracle which is above and beyond anything else. He says something that we just cannot explain in rational terms, and that is the continued existence of the Jewish people. He said that is a miracle which is non-explainable. He said, I can't explain it. I can't explain how we are still around, and the Romans, the Babylonians, you know, Mark Twain said it also. He said, you know, where are all these people? They're a footnote in history. And we, this tiny little nation, as Rabbi Sachs always points out, Jonathan Sachs says, we would not feature in the census in China. Because Chinese census has a leeway of 15 million. So if we were in China, it wouldn't even feature on the census. We wouldn't exist, right? And we're a tiny, tiny group of people, and we're still around. And we've outlived all of the oppressions and all of the bad guys. And, you know, it's a miracle, says Rabbi Emden, I cannot explain. He just does not have an answer. And in fact, he in his introduction to his Siddur, he talks about making Aliyah. This is 300 years ago, which wasn't easy. And he says he can't make Aliyah, even though he believes that that is part of what we should be doing, because of his health. He really was not a healthy man. And he... Sorry? I know, and there's some, yeah, and it's that is the, you know, in the Torah it talks about we're the smallest, but again, it's not about numbers. I know, it's always the same number. Yeah, because that is maybe a biblical requirement that Am Yisrael has to be around that number, reflecting the fact that we're such a small number. You know, what always got me in England when I was talking to colleagues at work, and I would say to them, how many Jews do you think living in the country? So they would say, maybe 2 million. 2.5 million. When I said it was 200,000, they didn't believe me, right? And it's always been around. Maybe the height of Anglo-Jewry was 400,000, but now there are 200,000, probably 250,000, approximately. And it's always been like, and it is a mystery, right? I don't know if I have an answer for you, because it's a mysterious thing, and we seem to go back to that number. And when we get a bit bigger, things happen and the number reduces. And it's kind of scary. The only thing we see today, which is a real bracha, is that in Israel, the number of Jews is increasing. There is not a diminution of numbers in Israel. Right? Remember with Golda Meir, we all spoke about 3 million Jews in Israel. Now we're talking about nearly 7 million Jews in Israel. It's incredible. I God forbid, I hope it's not going to go like that. You know, we just don't want to think about that in the future. You're right, it's a mystery. It is actually mysterious. But at the same time, we're still here. And that is really the message of Purim, that it's not that the holidays will be cancelled, but the message of the holiday will never, ever go away. There's always going to be discussion about major miracles took place in history, but the constant survival of the Jewish people, that's something that will never, ever go away. And Purim represents it. In the end of the day, everything about Purim, we're going to talk about it today, the 10th chapter of the Megillah. Everything about Purim is hidden. There's nothing in open sight. Everything is behind the scenes. And all of that is saying that with... And again, as we know, the name of God is not even in the book. So all of this suggests that, you know, we're dealing with a story here which has a real message, that when we can't see God openly, we should not assume, make an assumption that God is not there. On the contrary, God is there, but sometimes in a form, in a hidden form, which we have to struggle really very often to try and find. And of course, this is again, many people have spoken about sort of Holocaust experiences, and it's a very difficult topic. Some people, many came out of those experiences denying the existence of God. How can God exist? And I've met people who came out of those experiences more religious than before. And again, you know, we know that this is a phenomenon, and it's very, you know, I can't judge one way or the other, because I wasn't there, thank God, and I don't know how I would have reacted under those circumstances if I could have survived. I don't know.
This survival of ours is probably what irks the other nations.
It does bug them a little bit.
And no matter what has happened to us,
yeah,
Hashem is with us.
Yeah.
And therefore, what their religions and their beliefs are doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and this is really when you hear the evangelist talking about the Jews, this is what they say, right? That's why they get very excited about Israel and about the Jewish people. But there are a lot of Christians, I would argue the Catholics may look very friendly on the outside, but it must bug them to high heaven what's going on in Israel. Because till 1948, they thought that was it. The Jews were and they saw the Holocaust. That's why the Pope was such a rasha, an evil man, and he did nothing. Because he saw this as the ultimate fulfillment of the destruction of the Jews, as predicted by their covenant, or whatever they call it. And the reality was, along comes 1948, State of Israel, and all of a sudden, wow, Jews are back. And the Catholics really had a problem. For 50 years, they had no representation in Israel. They didn't have any sort of diplomat even in Israel. Now they've tried to make amends. So, you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, it must really bug them. How can we still be survive? How can we still be around? Right? The Jewish problem of Christianity. I once went to a talk on such a concept. The problem, or rather, Jesus and his Judaism, is, you know, and something like that. I mean, it just bugs them. It really bugs them. All right, I want to just leave it at that. But as I said, there's a lot more to say. It's a very exciting concept. The concept, not that the holiday, other holidays will go away, but they'll be overshadowed, but Purim will never be overshadowed. That's really what the rabbis are trying to tell us. And you know what? There's something to be said for that. What we're going to do today is very simple. We're going to finish the Megillah, chapter 10. Right? We got to this point, Shechiyanu, as they say. And we've got three verses at the end of the Megillah, which we all look forward to, because that's when, you know, everything sort of ends at that point. The reading of the Megillah is over. And I think we need to ask ourselves the very basic question, what are they doing here? What is this all about? I'll just read it. I don't know what it is. 1260? Is it 1261? What page is it? 1261. 1261. The last three verses of the Megillah. Listen to this. Chapter 10. And it's telling us some information which we can really ask the question, why? Lama. Why do we need to know this? Verse number 1. Vayosam ha-melech Achashverosh. And there's a whole discussion about how his name is spelled without the Vav and whatever, there's rabbinic literature on that. Achashverosh applied mas ala aretz v'yayam, taxes, right? He became a tax lord over the islands and the lands, etc. Thank you. That's it. That's what we're told. I mean, is that the way to end the story? V'chol ma'asei tokvo gvurato, and all of the story of his strength and his power, Uparshat Gedulat Mordechai, and the story how Mordechai was elevated, Asher Gidol HaMelech, that the king had elevated him, Elohim Ketuvim on Sefer Divrei Yamim Lamachay Modai Paras. You want to find out more details, as we did in this series of Shiurim, we looked at the history, but you've got to go to the history books. In this case, to the history books of Persia and Modai Media. Right? Again, what are you telling me? You're telling me that everything that I need to know in the background is about Mordechai is to be found in other places. Again, that's a strange way to end the book. And then look at the final verse. Ki Mordechai Yudi, Mishneh L'Achashverosh, we know in the end Mordechai became number 2 in the kingdom. Gadol LaYudim, he was great for the Jews. Ratzui L'Rov Echav, I point this out all the time. He was only, majority supported him, right? You know, they had a board meeting and the majority said he's okay. The minority said, not so sure about this guy. Mrs. Schulz, Doresh Tov Le'amo, he seeks good for his people, V'Dovesh Shalom L'chol Zaro, and speaks peace to all of his seed, all of his future generations. Thank you. What are you telling me? Mordechai's a good guy. I know Mordechai's a good guy. He's the hero of the whole story. So these three verses are very strange. We have the end of the Megillah, which we thought would end on a crescendo that the Jews are now celebrating throughout. You know, what do I want to see at the end of the Megillah? I want to see 127 countries having a tremendous celebration, an increase of Jewish identity, of Jewish awareness, and everything else. And all I'm told about, number one, Achashverosh is a tax man, right? And he's the IRS incarnate. Number two, Mordechai, you want to really find out the history, go and look in some other books. And you know what? Mordechai became the person, Mishneh LeMelech, he became the second in command. The rabbis, by the way, point out that Mordechai, Mishneh LeMelech, is reminiscent of another Mishneh LeMelech. Who was the other guy who became second in command? Yosef. Very interesting. There's a parallel between the story of Joseph and the story of Mordechai, right? Because they were both second in command. And one can ask a very, and rabbis do, and I've got it on the page here, they ask a similar question. For Mordechai to do what he did he have to now take on this incredibly high position? Could he have retracted, gone to Florida for a couple of months and leave it at that, or wherever, the equivalent, you know, sort of retire to Eilat? Or did he have to become this? And remember, they're all staying in the exile. This is not going to Israel. This is staying in Persia. And the same question is actually asked about Yosef. Surely, Yosef taking on and becoming the second to Pharaoh, it's very nice in the story and it gives a certain strength to what Yosef did, but did he have to become as great as that in order to facilitate bringing the family to Egypt and whatever? He didn't have to really rise to that level to do what he wanted to do, which was to bring the bring his family down to Egypt. The questions are very, very severe that this end of the Megillah, one rabbi says, and it's on the page that I gave you, section A, there's a rabbi called Rabbi Menachem ben Chel Bar Chelba. I've never heard of this guy before. It's the second paragraph. And he says that the whole Megillah is ending in an atmosphere of what he calls besetta, an atmosphere of darkness, of something which we don't understand. It's almost as if the last three verses are there to tell you, you thought you understand the story, and everything is hidden. Well, I'm going to show you from these last three verses that it looks obvious, but doesn't make any sense what we're being told over here. And therefore, the whole story needs to be treated in the same way. You think that you understood that this was a story of happenstance and all these things. You know what? It's not. It's a much deeper story. It's something that you have to look into. And again, the suggestion is that the Megillah ends on a strange note to emphasize this hidden quality of the story. That's a suggestion. You know, I'm a bit frustrated about that. You know, I like to sort of the what I call the Agatha Christie kind of ending. I want to find out who done it. I want to read the last page and know who committed the murder. And you know, I want to read the last page and say, this is the fantastic ending. You know what would have been great? That Mordechai and Esther would have said to the Jews in Persia, now we've got a chance to go back to Eretz Israel. They're building the second temple. Let's go. Let's do what we're told that we have to do, and Shalom Yisrael, we're going. And it doesn't say that. So this, by definition, these last three verses are very, very difficult. So if you want to say it's hidden, and we don't really understand, and you want to put it into some sort of cloud, fine. Beseder, you know, that's you're allowed to do that. I'll show you the page. Look at the page I gave. I gave you two pages. One is a double-sided, one is single. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I'll give you some suggestions of what rabbis say. Look at number two. There's a rabbi called Shlomo Alkebetz. Now you'll say to me, never heard of the guy, and the fact is everyone's heard of him. Because Shlomo Alkebetz is the author of Lecha Dodi. And, you know, he must have been pretty cool, because to make a poem like that, that every Jew in the world sings on a Friday night, to get all the Jews to do the same thing, that's a very, very amazing rabbi. Alright? Shlomo Alkebetz, his name is. He was a rabbi in Tzfat. There was the 1500s, was literally the glorious age of Tzfat. And there was the Shulchan Aruch, Joseph Kara was living there, Shlomo Alkebetz, Menorah Samor, all these great, great rabbis were living there. They wanted to bring Mashiach. And they wanted to institute Semicha, which is not what we call it today, but bring back the whole concept of what Moshe Rabbeinu had done, you know, anointing leaders and all this sort of thing. And it just never happened. When you go to Tzfat, you do get this sense that this is a very unusual place, right? It's not your regular run-of-the-mill place. It's up in the hills. It's very... People running around there also seem a little bit off, you know, use the word, a bit wacky. Some of the people living there, and you know, you always wonder about that. Plus all the artists that are in the artist quarter there. It's sort of place that, you know, one dreams about living, because it is a very special place. In the winter, it's very cold up there. I just have to warn you. But the reality is, that's what. So we're going back 500 years. So look at Rabbi Shlomo Alkebetz. This is number two on the first page that you have. Right, page one, this is number two on the right hand side. Just read a little bit. He says, Beferush lo no dalami, Matsati Kadi. He says he's got a commentary which was anonymous, which he read. And it said, Vazelashono, the rabbi who he's quoting said, Hakol nit mahu, everyone is amazed. Ma inyan katuv zekam. What is this whole verse over here about Achashverosh at the beginning of chapter 10? What is it telling us? That he was a tax man? What do I need to know that for? What are we going to gain? What are we going to lose if we didn't know this? And why add in the fact that you've got Achashverosh on one hand and you've got Mordechai on the other hand and you're putting them together? What do you gain by telling us that? And he says something very interesting. And this is true. The king was very successful. Made a lot of money. He managed to tax all of the 127 countries. Even countries that were initially not under his control. Right? He expanded the empire, the king. Because they were afraid of him. So you'll say, why was he so successful? Why did Achashverosh, King Xerxes, become so great? Because he had a good supporter, the Jew. Right? And this is true. This is Jewish history. Go back to the 1400s in Poland. There weren't Jews living in Poland by the time the Second World War comes around, 3.5 million Jews living in Poland. So what happened? The answer is that when the Jews are being expelled from Western Europe, from France, from England, from all these other places, and obviously in 1492 from Spain, they went, they found a place for them in Poland. Go figure. Why were they taken into Poland? Because the king at the time realized, you bring the Jews into your country, things start moving, the economy gets going. And he was smart. He was a guy who appreciated the fact you bring in the Mordechais, and all of a sudden you've got a thriving country. And you know what? You go to Poland today, and if you've been there, right, and recently, but you go, I was there 1996, and you see a country where it's grey. You see all of the remnants of the Jewish community, all the buildings, the shuls, which have basically all been desecrated, most of them. But you see what the Jewish life was like, and you see a country which is devoid of Jews. There's no Jews there. And it's dead. It's a country where that time when I was there, to me, I was like I was in a third world country. We were told that if you go on the trams in Warsaw, be careful with your wallets or whatever, because there are pickpockets on all the trams. So what happened? We went on a tram. I was with another two teachers, and one teacher had her wallet stolen on the tram the day before we're going back to London. Her passport was in her wallet. So go figure. She got stuck in Poland. She had to stay for a whole week after we left because she couldn't get out because she didn't have a passport. And this was crazy. And this is what goes on when you're in a country where you know that the people are desperate for, you know, they steal whatever they can get their hands on. And that's Poland without its Jews. And you know, Magia Lehem, I don't care. If they wanted to get rid of the Jews the way they... And all this apologetics that's going on at the moment is driving me crazy. The reality is that they were complicit. And why did Hitler make Auschwitz in Poland? Because that was the place. He could get away with it. And he knew, doing it in Germany, there would be people running up against him, so it wasn't such a great amount of stuff going on in Germany as well. But Poland was where he could really carry out his evil plan. No question in my mind, and that's what it's about. So this is a suggestion here that Ahasuerus, going back into ancient history, why was he so successful? Why could he make taxes on the whole world? The reason is because he had Mordechai with him. He had the Jew, the court Jew. Right, which is a concept also in history that we have for in many, many places. And that's the reason why it mentions Mordechai at the end, together with Ahasuerus. Okay, says, this is again from Rabbi Bachrach, who I've been talking about quite a long time already. Look at the last four lines, last six lines on the bottom of the right-hand side. He says, the Divrei HaRishon Ikrosha Perek Hu Tokfo Shel Ahasuerus. In other words, we're now saying, either this chapter 10 is giving us the great news about Ahasuerus, who beschut Mordechai, and he did it all in the merit of Mordechai. And according to the Ralbag, there's another suggestion, one of the great commentaries, who says, Ikur shatokfo shel Mordechai. It's really all about the strength of Mordechai. But ledat kul, in other words, it's either telling us the greatness of Ahasuerus or the greatness of Mordechai, in their own way. But whatever it is, why do we need to know this? We know this already. I know Ahasuerus is very powerful, and I know Mordechai is very influential. Why do I need to repeat this at the end of the Megillah? So Rabbi Bachrach is not happy with these suggestions. And he says something extraordinary. He says, Ahasuerus, the author of the Megillah is trying to be, what's the word? You start and you finish, you sort of close the book. You started off with Ahasuerus. What did we see at the beginning? He made these big parties, these diplomatic receptions, and everything that we spoke about at the beginning. And at the end, what do we see? He takes taxes from everybody. So this is a man who, right through the story, has not changed. He's a money grabber. He's a man who is after power, period. In fact, when you look in Wikipedia, if you ever do, and you read the story of Xerxes I, he's actually assassinated. Eventually, he became so big with his own importance that I think around 470-something, which is after the Purim story ends, Ahasuerus is killed. Xerxes is done away with. And the new king comes along, and that becomes the whole discussion afterwards with Darius and the building of the Second Temple. It's all very interesting what is going to happen later on. But the reality is, and he points out here that maybe it's telling us about Ahasuerus, who he was, he never changed. One of the things about studying the Megillah is that one of the misconceptions people have, Ahasuerus is a buffoon, he's a bit of a glomp, he's a bit of an idiot. Boy, oh boy, you can't be more wrong. This is a man who, as we saw, fought the wars, right? I was very excited 2 days ago. There was a TV show. Don't know which one it was. I don't remember. And they asked a question. And the question was, who fought the war against the Greeks in 480 BCE? And I jumped up and I said, I know who it was. Nobody in the audience had a clue. They'd never heard of Xerxes. I was shocked. Maybe I'm not so shocked. Maybe it's true. But I really knew the answer to, you know, it's like Jeopardy. You know, what, that one answer that you know because you've actually studied something. It was really exciting. It wasn't Jeopardy. It was another program. I don't remember what it was. Very funny, right? We knew the answer to a question which nobody else knew. That's the suggestion. He says that Ahasuerus were being told never change. The leopard didn't change his spots. He was bad at the beginning. He was bad in the middle because he gives Haman the free rein to kill the Jews. And he's bad at the end. You think he's done tshuva. He's become a little bit of a better person. Not likely. Reality is that what does he do at the end? He makes taxes. Right? If you're making a tax, it's not just about the money. It's about the power. It's about the control. Because when you tax people, they go under your thumb. And he can then conscript them to his army if they don't pay their taxes. And, you know, the whole thing of taxation, not representation in this case, on the contrary. Taxation here means avdut, means slavery. So that's the suggestion, says Rabbi Bachra, for Ahasuerus. We're being told at the end, there's a kind of symmetry. We're told about the bad guy at the beginning. We had the bad guy in the middle. And you know what? He's still a bad guy at the end. Okay, that's Ahasuerus. He says at the bottom here, what about telling us about Mordechai? Can we expand on that? So he says that, you know what? And this is where he compares Mordechai to Yosef. If you turn over the page to the second side, page 2, you'll see that there's something very, very interesting. And he says like this, and it's the top line on page 2 on the right-hand side, middle of the line. Ma'alo li Yosef, if we compare Mordechai to Yosef, because it's telling us Mordechai was number 2 in the kingdom. And Yosef, we know, was number 2 in Egypt. So he says the same question really we're asking about Mordechai, what we're being told here, we can ask about Yosef. What's the question? Ma'alo li Yosef, sheyotze mibeit ha'asurim, Yosef leaves the jail, limloch ha'kol eretz Mitzrayim, to become the king of Egypt. Because he basically becomes the viceroy. Ma'alo peh, or rather, ma'alo po ba'aretz nachriyah, lerechev or lirkob b'merkevet ha'mishnah. Why would he want to have all the glory and to ride in the limousine of the vice president, lasuma la'av leparo, and to be literally over a patron of Pharaoh, la'adon l'chol beito, and a master for the whole home? So he says, Tomer, some people will say, you know why Yosef had to have it? Because the dream said that he's going to become great. And everyone's going to bow down to him. So he wanted to facilitate a situation where the brothers would come to Egypt with the father, and they would bow down. Although it says his mother was going to bow down, mother was dead. But some say it refers to Bilhah, one of the maid servants, who probably took over bringing him up when his mother died. Whatever it is, the reality of the situation is maybe Yosef is doing what he's doing to make the dreams come true. That's the Ramban says that, Nachmanides. But you go down the page where it says, Mordechai like Yosef. That paragraph which begins underline Al-Kain. So he says, therefore, Haya Yosef Rosh HaGola Rishona L'Zeh Avraham. He wants to suggest that there's another reason. That Abraham was told that his progeny, his descendants, will become a blessing for the whole world. So Yosef felt that this is him. He is in a position not only to do for his people, for his brethren, but he's doing for the whole world. And you know what it means to do for the whole world? To feed them and to supply them with produce and to supply them with he saved literally a whole economy, saved a whole nation. He saved a whole area of the world, because without that food and everything that he put aside, they would have all died of famine. So the reality of Yosef, he says, is to become the person who helps and supplies food to the whole world. And he says, where it says the word Mordechai on the right hand side, ve'edot b'Mordechai kamo b'Yosef. So we're going to say the same thing about Mordechai. Asher shamo Elokim la'adon l'chol beit Ahasuerus. He's become the master of the house of Ahasuerus. U'moshel b'chol ha'medinot. And he's ruling all of the countries. Kedei la'odia ba'amim tokfo shel am mefuzar mefurah bad amim, is to tell all the world that the Jews are still around, like we said before. Asher lo yebo el zar v'lo yishtach el necha, they're never going to give up their religion. In other words, Mordechai becomes the quintessential Jew. And for everybody around the world, they see Mordechai and they see the Jew, but not the Jew in Eretz Israel, it's the Jew in the diaspora. But they learn from Mordechai that there is going to be no compromise. You think you could come against the Jew and make him convert, and unfortunately this happened over and over again. The reality was that those converts disappear, and the Jew who stays faithful to the tradition of Israel survives. And as I said before, go figure. Difficult to explain. And maybe that's what's coming on in the end. You want to read about Mordechai in the history books, go and read about him in the history books. But what we're talking about in verse 3 is Mordechai HaYehudi. We're talking about Mordechai as the Jew, who becomes so powerful, Doresh Tov Le'amol, Dovesh Shalom L'chol Zaro, someone who is looking out for his people and becomes the quintessential Jew for the whole world to view, to see. That's another suggestion, meaning, of course, what the end of the story is doing is finishing off the circle of Achashverosh, and at the same time telling us about Mordechai and the effect that Mordechai had on the whole world. However, one problem, he said, this is all very nice, and it's all very exciting, but there's one issue, and it's what we said before. Mordechai is now elevated to greatness. You know, he's the vice president of the country. He's not the president, that's Xerxes, Achashverosh, but he's the vice president. Doresh Tov and his Mishnah Lemelech Achashverosh. What we are not seeing, and what we would have hoped to see, as I said before, is some message from Mordechai that I know we're in the exile, and I know we're doing well, and I know we have lobbies in Washington and in London and in all these places, but our focus should be Eretz Israel. That's where the Jew is the strongest, because in Eretz Israel, you get a different type of Jew. You don't get a Jew who has to run away for his life, you get a Jew who stands up and says, never again, and he means it. And Menachem Begin said it, he said that the lesson of the Holocaust is only one lesson, that when they say they're going to kill us, they mean to do it. Don't ever assume that they don't mean to follow what they're actually saying. This is Begin's. I would say not Chiddush, but it was certainly Begin's comment. And that's what Israel today represents. It represents the power, the strength, the tremendous uplift of the Jewish people. And what Rav Bachrach says, and I'm going to go to the third page, the final thought. The final thought is like this. Purim is a story of redemption. Purim is a tremendous story of Geula, of the Jewish people being redeemed in the diaspora. And we know, over and over again, Jews will be in trouble and they will be redeemed, right? Many Hasidic stories, the Rebbe stood up and made a pronouncement that I saw a decree in heaven against the Jews of Russia, right? Rebbe Levi Yitzchok Paditcheva, there's always many stories like that. And I prayed and whatever, and I made sure that the decree was annulled. How he knew, who knows? This is talking about Rebbes. And the reality is that this is the story of the Jew in the Gola, in the exile. But the problem is, maybe the Megillah, says Rav Bachrach, is leaving us with a question mark. The question mark is, what then should be the attitude of the Jew when it comes to the issue to rebuilding Eretz Israel? At the end of the Megillah, we saw this all the way through, the challenge was to rise to what had happened from previous years, that Koresh, Cyrus, had given the Jews permission to go back to Israel. And remember, we said right at the beginning, the Jews never took it up. They had a year in which they could go back to Israel, and they all said no. A few Chalutzim went, and they tried to build the temple, and the project failed miserably at the beginning. And it was on hold. It was on hold for maybe over 100 years. And eventually it got built, but much between the time of Cyrus and when the temple was built is the Purim story. And the Purim story is saying, yes, God is on our side. He protects us. He's with us in the exile. But there's got to be a focus, even when we find ourselves in comfortable circumstance in the exile. After the story of Purim, the Jews were feared. Mordechai is right up there with everybody else. He's on top of the world. But you know what's missing? A focus towards Eretz Israel. It's not there. And that maybe is the critique of the end of the story. I tell you why I say this, because on Sunday, one of the things I mentioned about the writing of the Megillah story, and this is again an interesting thing, that Esther and Mordechai wrote it, but it was, according to the Gemara, it was written down by the men of the Great Assembly. So who were they? Who were the men of the Great Assembly? So we know that when the Jews started going back to Eretz Israel, some of the prophets that remained, the last of the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, they went back as well. They were in Eretz Israel, and they gathered 120 people together, and they made a court, as it were, a group. There's 120 seats in the Knesset today because of that. It's an interesting thing. And the men of the Great Assembly wrote the Megillah. So you'll say, wait a minute, Mordechai wrote it, Esther wrote it. What do you mean the men of the Great Assembly? The answer is that Mordechai and Esther wrote it down as more of a history. The men of the Great Assembly wrote it as a spiritual document. And it was canonized. It was put in the Bible. So if you say that's the case, then you, I think I understand what we're getting at here. That the men... Sorry? To kill Amalek, yeah. By the prophet, Shmuel. Yeah. He refused. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Shmuel, Samuel. Yeah, he excused. Yeah, big mistake. Correct. You will need it because they'll be gone. Correct, correct. And all of that for one. And he meant, you know, as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? You know, the yellow brick road, but it's going in a bad direction, this. And you're right. You're absolutely right. And it needed a Purim, and then we've suffered ever since because we just did not finish the job, and we've still got Amalek with us to this very day. Maybe not descendants direct, but the anti-Semite becomes the Amalekite today. And we can't, it's one of those mysteries that seems just to go on and on and on. Yeah, yeah. There's suggestion they were already involved there. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Esau's son. Yeah, Esau's son. Yeah. It's still one of those. It's a mystery of Jewish history that this situation continues. I'm going to just finish. I want to show you what he says at the end. We're going to read the last section halfway down on the final thought. Where it says, Gam beperika achro nichtav beseitera. Right? He says that really the last chapter of the Megillah has within it a certain amount of hidden thunder, he says. What does that mean? Im tirtse timtsa bo etamsit kol ha-Megillah. If you look, you'll find in the last chapter of the Megillah the whole essence of the story. Vehi mutzeket ha-galut, hi mutzukat ha-galut, because it tells us the challenge, the difficulty of being in the diaspora, and at the same time that we should be looking for salvation to return to Israel. And he wants to suggest that the Megillah maybe doesn't spell it out, but by the very fact that we think that we're doing so well and Mordechai is so elevated, that is another challenge for us, that we are still in the diaspora. We're not in the obvious place where Jews are meant to be, which is in the land of Israel. And therefore, his suggestion is that the Megillah is ending with a challenge. The challenge is, how do we respond to these events? Do we remain complacent and just carry on as if nothing happened? And we're going to stay in the diaspora forever and ever, which I'm sure is what the Jews in Poland in 1939 thought. We've been here for 1,000 years. We're going to be here for another 1,000 years. And by 1943, there wasn't a Jew left in the whole of Poland. And it's shocking that history does that to us and we don't learn the lesson. Now again, I don't know whether we should get Zionistic at this point and say that, what are we doing sitting in America? We should be looking towards Israel. I would argue that today it's a different concept. If we're not going to go physically to be there, but at least we can support it, and all of us do in all different ways, we can certainly, our children go and our grandchildren go. My granddaughter, please God, is telling us already she's going to live in Israel. And you know, and I can't get upset about that. I'm excited about that. Because that's our whole education, is geared towards Israel. And we want them to be Zionists, so they come to the age of 21 and they become Zionists. What a shock. You know, we've just been training them to do this for 21 years. So it's not one of those things that is a bad thing, but it's a challenge. And this is what he says at the end. Ukamor, where it's underlined, the last 10 lines. Ukamor Yosef HaMishnah LeMelech HaRishon, just as with Yosef, who rose to the top of the tree in Egypt. Rotsa ya gamhu letzavod leecham, lasbiat amo al eit pikudatam. And remember, he wants to tell them, his brothers, that there'll come a time when you have to go back. You're not in Egypt forever because you're going to go back to Eretz Israel. Va'alitim et atzmotzai mizeitchem, and you're going to have to take my bones, which is what they did. Remember, he was in a coffin, buried in the River Nile, and the coffin came up. It was a lead coffin. One of the miracles that happened. So he says, Kamo Yosef. Gam kein gam hurotze bepasuk acharon. In this final verse of the Megillah, what are we being told? Ledaber shalom lechol zaro, dover shalom lechol zaro. The Mordechai is talking peace to all of his future descendants, meaning legalot lahem et soda gulachrona. That Mordechai, in the end, dover shalom lechol zaro, means that he really wants to encourage them to go back. His suggestion is, it's not Mordechai being complacent, it's Mordechai realizing that his situation for himself is that he won't go back, and there's a big argument whether Mordechai does go back to Israel or not. Most of the rabbis say he doesn't, but he is going to be Dover Shalom, that in the end, it will create a situation where we will go back to Eretz Israel. And it happens because in the end of the story of the Megillah, we read the book of Nehemiah, and this is what we're going to do Bezrat Hashem next week. We're going to see in the story of Nehemiah, the fact is that the Jews do decide to go back, they do build the second temple, and they make a chag. And you know what day they make a chag to celebrate the second temple rebuilding? The 16th of Adar. I'm going to show you this next week. Isn't that interesting? So they had 14th and 15th of Adar, Purim, to celebrate the events outside Israel. And when they come back into Eretz Israel, they make a new holiday, the 16th. And Nehemiah is saying to the Jewish people, it's all a process. We left 14th and 15th and we had that whole salvation. Now, the 16th, we're going to Israel and we're going to celebrate the new Commonwealth of the State of Israel with a new holiday attached to the old holiday, but as it were, explaining to everybody what the old was leading to the new. The salvation from Persia was leading to the new temple, the new age. And again, I'm not going to sort of say more, but next week, Bezrat Hashem, I want to show you this because it's very fascinating. So he says at the end, and look at these final comments, the final comment at the bottom of the page, Mordechai haya matukan ligula. This is a quote from Bereishit Rabbah, from the Midrash, that Mordechai was matukan, he was prepared, he was in a position of tikkun, to bring about gula, redemption. So what we're saying now is the following. Back to chapter 10, we're saying, yes, it finishes off, Ahasuerus tells us that he never really became anything other than a completely despicable individual. We know that Mordechai became very high up, and with all the challenges, as with Yosef, and it does create a certain amount of question marks in our mind, but the bottom line is, when it says that Mordechai was someone who was the quintessential leader of the Jewish community in the exile, Dover Shalom Lechol Zaro, in the end, even Mordechai realizes, he understands, I've got to point the Jews back to Israel. And that's what it means, Dover Shalom, point to Midrash, Metukan Ligula, I've got to prepare them for redemption. And at the end of the story of Purim, round about the year, 470 approximately, this is a few years after the Purim story is over, the Jews begin to return with Ezra and Nehemiah, and by the year 450, the whole Second Temple project is finished, the walls of Jerusalem are built, and the Jewish community in Eretz Israel is established for the future, and it's there for another 400 years. So with seeing the end of the Megillah, it's not now as irrelevant as we thought it was. In fact, it's very relevant. Because the bottom line of Megillat Esther is to say the Jew in the Galut is always going to be in a, let's use the word, dicey situation. If the non-Jew wants to take away his patronage towards you, you're out. And we know this can happen overnight. It happens overnight. I'll tell a little story that in 1979 I went on Aliyah to live in Israel. And we had neighbors in the absorption center. They used to have these places where you went before you found an apartment. And my neighbor, one of my neighbors, was from Iran. And obviously what had happened is that over the Iranian Revolution, 1979, he ran away. And he ran away and he came to Jerusalem. And it made perfect sense, and many Jews had to get out because the Iranian government was going crazy. And he's there, and then I'm saying to myself, one day I haven't seen him. He usually got out in the morning. We used to see him come out of the house. Didn't see the guy. Disappeared. Where is he? So I wanted to know because I hadn't seen him maybe now a couple of days. I went to the guy running the absorption center. I said, what happened to my neighbor? And he said, oh, he's gone back to Iran. I said, what? I said, he went back to Iran? He said, yeah, he had business there, whatever, and he couldn't leave it behind, and he thought he could go. And if this man is still alive today, it will be a miracle. It will be a nace. I really don't believe he's alive anymore. And the reality of it is that that's the challenge. That Jews in the diaspora may feel very comfortable, let's use the word materially, you know, even spiritually to a large extent, there are great yeshivot in the diaspora. But the bottom line of what Megillat Esther is really saying, according to what Rav Bachrach is saying here, which is so beautiful, is that even Mordechai realizes with all his elevation, the focus is Dover Shalom L'chol Zaro, to reveal to the Jews, you know what the real future will be when it's Dover Shalom, when I tell you the recipe for redemption. And therefore Mordechai in the end becomes a redemptive character. And again, it's a twist, it's not necessarily so clear in the text. As the rabbi puts it over here, it's hidden. It's one of the themes of the Megillah that there's so much hidden material, but it's a powerful message at the end. What we still need to do, I'm going to hold it here because I thought there was going to be another speaker. I don't know if the guy is coming. I was told he's going to be here at 10:15. So I'm going to hold it here, but I'm just going to introduce what we're going to do in the next 2 weeks. Purim's in 2 weeks' time. Sorry? Yeah, it's the whole thing we've been speaking about. It's that in the year 539 was the end of the 70 years of exile. You know, they had to be in exile for 70 years. So in 539, King Cyrus, the Persian king, who took over the Babylonian kingdom, he says to the Jews, he says to everybody, go home. I don't want to control you guys anymore, because much better, you live in your own surroundings, your own country. And he was going to send them back. For 1 year, they had a chance to go, and minimal. Nobody went. They all stayed in Persia, because it was so good in Persia. We know that the whole story, the beginning of the Purim story, was, you know, everyone's doing great. By the time you get to the Purim story and beyond, that's moved from Cyrus to Xerxes, to Ahasuerus, who becomes very powerful in the big wide world, and begins to lose his power and to lose his ability to control. So it all revolves around Shushan, goes back to the capital of the empire. And what happens at that point is a whole discussion, which we've spoken about quite in length, about what the interaction is between him and the Jewish people. Did he really want the Jews to be killed? There is no question from the way we understand it that he gave Haman free hand to do whatever he wanted. So Ahasuerus is really a bad guy. When do the Jews finally go back? Not when Ahasuerus is alive anymore. He's dead. But he marries Esther. Esther stays with him. This is one of the things we're going to talk about. And they have a child. They had a child together called Darius. Darius is written in history in the book of Nehemiah that he gives permission for the Jews to build the second temple. So there's a bit of an irony, a historical irony, that even though Esther, who meant to be the quintessential Jewish heroine, she in fact lives with the non-Jew for many, many years afterwards, and she has a child with him, but that child becomes a savior of the Jewish people. He's Jewish. His mother's Esther. But the reality of it is that this all takes place, the story of the Megillah, between the original call to return to Israel, the fact that the Jews did not listen to the call, and then by the time you get to the post-Purim historical period, which is around the year 470 after Purim is over, all of a sudden, the Jews start going back. Because Ezra comes along and says, Rabotai, Igia Zaman Shel Gula. We've got to go back. And Ezra goes, and Nehemiah goes, and some of the prophets that are still alive go. And it begins to revive. The Jewish community revives. So it's an interesting thing. That in the bigger picture of the story of Purim is really the struggle. Is the Jew meant to be in the diaspora, or is the Jew meant to be in Israel? And of course, 21st century, this is the same struggle that we have. Now, again, don't get me wrong that this is not an advert for the Jewish agency that I'm putting forward here, right? Because it doesn't apply, everybody has their own calculations to make. But what I think today, what we all do, and it upsets me that so many Jews are disconnecting because of the political propaganda that's going on, BDS, I mean, it's a scandal. And Jews, young Jews in college are getting caught up in this, that they are going, moving away from supporting Israel and all the rest of it. That's something that we need to work on. If we can't get people to go and to live there, but at least our support, the strength that we can give to Israel, and what they give to us, which is equally as amazing, that is something that we need to really, you know, we need to think about it, we need to develop it, we need to make it grow. And I'm despairing at the number of young Jews that literally are prepared to buy into the propaganda, and it is propaganda, right? Apartheid. I worked in Colombia for 15 years. Every year they had a week called Apartheid Week, where they would blame Israel and call Israel an apartheid state. It's not an apartheid. This week there was a Muslim woman who's become a police officer. It was a wonderful picture in the, I saw it online. There's a judge, one of the Supreme Court is an Arab Druze, I think. And, you know, that's an apartheid country, that they're really not doing apartheid very well. Because, you know, they're giving very senior positions to people who supposedly they're meant to be, you know, putting down. So go figure the propaganda. But the propaganda doesn't listen. They don't want to listen, they want to scream, they want to shout, they want to just drown out the voice of reason. And that's what we're dealing with today. So I think the story of the Megillah, and this is really one of the powerful lessons, it doesn't go away. Yes, the exile is a place where we live. Diaspora is where we flourish. Thank God today, American Jews are flourishing. But at the same time, it all comes back to our connection to Israel. And I really believe that. And if we don't have that connection, or we see a generation that is disconnecting, I worry for the future of that generation in the diaspora. Because as long as you're connected to Israel, there is a Jewishness, which it's a lifeline. When that lifeline goes away, I don't know. I don't know what to say, and it's kind of disturbing. So again, please go next week. We'll talk a bit more of what I'm calling chapter 11 of the Megillah, which is, again, according to Rav Lau, we're going to go and look at the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. And then also, right at the end, maybe in 2 weeks' time, which will be after day after Purim, Shushan Purim, we'll hopefully be meeting on that day. I'll talk a little bit about what happened to Esther after the story ends. Very, very, very controversial, very interesting, and not necessarily something that I would tell my grandmother. You know, my grandmother would be horrified if I told her this story. She would not be a happy camper if she was still around to hear it. You know what? Sometimes we've got to get real. But these are amazing, amazing people. I hope that's become clear. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, again? Oh, I don't even want to think about it. Don't want to think about it. Thank you, everybody. And if I don't see you before Purim, if you're not here next week, then have a wonderful, meaningful holiday, because it is a very special holiday. Thank you, everybody.